So welcome to Tuesday morning's Dhamma talk. And as I promised last night, that this talk would be about insight. And it's a big word which is a bit overexpressed, I reckon, in the Dhamma, but it's still very important. So today I'll be saying what insight is, how it works, how important it is, and how it's used. But first of all, for developing insight, well, what can insight really mean? It's seeing things clearly. But a lot of times people don't see things clearly. And the first example here is a story which I usually tell on every retreat. And this actually came from when one of my friends from Cambridge came to visit. His name is Bernard Carr. He's a professor of theoretical physics, emeritus now, at Queen Mary or Elizabeth College or something over in London University. A very close disciple and helper of Stephen Hawking's when Stephen Hawking was alive. And a good friend of mine. He's also a Buddhist. He was the first Buddhist I ever met, other than myself. And okay, the story of that. I love telling stories, even though it's a bit off subject. At that university, you could join all these clubs, and those clubs all met together so that at the beginning of your university career, you could actually, you know, develop your social life and things you're interested in. And I was a Buddhist when I was 16, but then I didn't know what to do next, because I never saw any monks or nuns or anything. But then when I went to this society's fair where you could join all these different societies which you were interested in, that was one thing I saw there. The Cambridge University Buddhist Society. And I was really excited. You didn't need to give me any sherry to join that one. I just really wanted to. I went up to the counter and said, I want to join. And the guy behind the counter said, you don't have to join. This is Buddhism. Come and see. I said, no, I'm a Buddhist, I want to join. Look, take it easy, you don't have to join. You know, come and see if you like it, then you can join. Look, I'm a Buddhist, I want to join. And I took a pound note out, slammed it on the table, and said, sign me up. And that young man, that was Bernard. He was just manning the stall that day, or that morning. So he became a very good friend. But then, he got into theoretical physics, big time. I got into Buddhism, big time. But we still kept in touch, and he came to one of our conferences here. And when he came to one of our conferences here, I made sure that I couldn't meet him at the airport. He came in about midnight. So we arranged a nice hotel for him, and I went to see him early in the morning to meet him, welcome him. And I welcomed him alone. He came with his wife, a Japanese girl. And I came with his wife, and I just sat on the table with him, just the two of us. And I said, listen, I know all the people who are coming to this conference, this Buddhist conference. I know they're all dying to ask you, what was Ajahn Brahm really like when he was a student? But I know what you were really like when you were a student. And your wife is here. So we're going to make a deal. I won't tell her if you don't tell you God. We shook on it and that was good. But anyhow, again, he has some wonderful stories. You know, he's a Buddhist, but he was also into psychic research. Ghost hunting. Not coffins, but real ghosts. And for many years, he was either the treasurer or the last few years, the president of the London Society for Psychic Research. And he tried to keep that quiet. He told me to keep it quiet because he thought that some people might feel that he's not a real scientist if he starts to investigate the weird stuff. But you know, we know each other, so that's what science should really be. And if there are ghosts, why? What are they? What do they do? How are they? But anyway, some of the things which they do in that Psychic Research Society, experiments. And one day he announced, or it wasn't him, it was one of his colleagues, announced that they discovered the secret of levitation. Being able to rise things in the air. And because he was a well-known scientist, the fellow who said he discovered how to do this, he said, I'll do a demonstration in Imperial College London, in one of the lecture theatres. And we're going to bring as many detectors, infrared, ultraviolet, videos, everything you want, to make sure if it works, you all have proof of it. And so he had all his professors in the laboratory, and then he brought in a flower pot, just held it, no strings or any wires or anything. And so he put it on the table and said, now in front of you all, you're all experimental physicists. You always got good reputations. You know, that you're trained observers. Now, I'm going to show how this flower pot levitates. But I want you to create an atmosphere in this room. I want each one of you, I don't care what religion you are or no religion, to start chanting the holy word Om. And they got all the videos, all the equipment charged up. If anything happened, they could record it, photograph it. And all these old professors and lecturers, researchers, all started chanting Om, Om, Om. And then the flower pot rose into the air. It actually worked. This flower pot lifted up above the table. They photographed it, videoed it, had so much evidence it actually lifted. And then after they lowered it down again, he asked all those people who'd witnessed this with their own eyes, what happened? And as one or two of those trained observers said, it never rose at all, it was on the table all the time. They showed them the videos, they showed them the photographs. They said it did rise above the table. They said, nope, I was watching, it never rose at all. And that was the whole purpose of the experiment. It did rise above the table. And the reason it rose above the table was because there was a huge electromagnet under the table. And when they turn something with demand such a huge current, you can hear the current buzzing in the wires. That's why they had to do Om, Om, Om. So hide the trick. It was just a huge current turning on an electromagnet to rise the flower pot up in the air. But even though it had a natural explanation, because a couple of those scientists did not know that natural explanation, they weren't informed. For them, their brain filtered it out. It couldn't happen. It's against everything they knew. Flower pots don't just rise up above the table. And because it was not allowed by their views of science, they didn't even see it. It never registered in their brain. And that was the whole purpose. Something which was actually happened right in front of you, evidence to support it. If that challenges your beliefs too much, you wipe it off your brain. You don't even see it. That is one of the reasons why I said that bare attention is not enough to get insight. Whatever you're watching, whatever you're feeling, whatever you're hearing, your brain adds and subtracts from that. And then what it brings you for your attention is already filtered. That's what it was proving. So how can you trust anything? You may have a nimitta. Is it a real nimitta? Are you sure? or has your brain added it or taken it away? Now that is always a problem with knowledge, truth. Why is it there are so many very highly intelligent human beings and they don't agree on what the truth is? You'd think that if there was such a thing as truth, and these were highly intelligent people, why can't they agree? It's because of that what you see, hear, smell, taste, touch and know is filtered. What is it filtered by? What is the process of filtering what comes into your brain, into your awareness? What filters it is something which the Buddha called the five hindrances. First of all, desire. Second, ill will. Sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse and doubt. Where actually are those? Sometimes we think we can be aware of those things. Can we? Properly? Because sometimes what desire does, it presents to you what you want to see. What ill will does, it hides the truth. Now there are some things which are just so hard to accept that you bury it. That's where the problems of abuse comes from the past. It's so terrible just, you know, to think that actually happened that you can't even see it. This is where those first two hindrances distort reality and present to you a world which, you know, you think is true, but it isn't. Another example of that is your own body. And sometimes you may have a little bump on your breast or something, or you may have a little tension in your heart, and you say, oh no, this is nothing. You know that sort of your body is always telling you if there's any disease, any cancer, any heart problems, it tells you. But imagine that that was happening. That's really scary. And because of that, you will distort the information. You won't accept it. That's just a bump, it's a mosquito bite or something. You won't accept it because the truth is not pleasant. How many times in relationships the one of the partners says, look, I can't stand you, I'm leaving. And then it's a shock to the other partner. They just haven't seen it. And they say to their wife, why didn't you tell me? I could have done something about this. She said, I was telling you for the last year. Don't think the person is being stubborn. It's that, you know, the separation was so distressing for them, they can't even see it. They always bend the truth to fit what they want to see. And it's something they don't do because they're bad people. It's done almost subconsciously. So because of that, you can see just how these hindrances bend the truth. So what you see is not actually what's real. It's distorted. And that's also the case for when, it's an obvious one, when you've got sloth and torpor. The world is very dull and grey for you. You can't see clearly. And it's like, you know, the world is saying there's a problem here. But you just, oh, yeah, maybe. You can't see it clearly because there's no energy in the mind. And the same with restlessness and worry, which is always means the mind is wandering all over the place. You see her and it's trying to tell you an important thing, and then you see over there, and you see somewhere else, and you see somewhere else. You never stay still enough to really see what's truly there. And I've said that many times here, that when that restlessness does disappear, and you are still, it's amazing just how this world just opens up to you. There's so much here, and much of it is beautiful, which is almost like an added benefit, which, you know, you never suspected. So if I really open my eyes and see this world, isn't this world suffering? Yes, it is, but there's an incredible amount of beauty there as well. And so that's where you can see so many wonderful things. Remember that saying about insight. I never actually mentioned it was about insight, but that was William Blake's little four-line part of a poem. To see a world in a grain of sand. Can you see a world in a grain of sand? That's an insight practice. To see a heaven in a wildflower. That's where you find there's actually joy in doing this. Incredible joy, a whole heaven in a little wildflower by the side of the path. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand. I love that one. In a small thing like the palm of your hand, things with no boundaries, no limits, infinite in the palm of your hand, an eternity in an hour, which is the length of my talks. Yeah, I know sometimes they go on and on and on, eternity. But you can sort of understand that it means that time has no meaning anymore. Now that's a kind of insight which sometimes people don't expect. Because you can't work that out through logic. Once you see it, then you can justify it through logic by working backwards. But actually to get there without sort of some experience, some opening up of the mind, some seeing clearer than you've ever seen before, that's quite rare. And the last thing is doubt. What actually is doubt? You know, it's very hard, you know, to describe it. In the old days, I used to follow some of the ways which the Buddha described doubt, but they never actually really made it clear to me, I must admit. One of those was, they used to say, being lost in a desert. So once there was a story of this guy who was lost in the desert for days. He didn't know which way to go. He was running out of water, crawling on his hands and knees in the hot sun. And he was really afraid he's going to die. And so he was just hoping for anything. And in the distance, you know, he saw something shimmering on the horizon. First of all, he thought, this is just a mirage, which happens in the deserts. So he didn't give it any importance. But as he was crawling on his hands and knees with his last ounces of strength, he saw that mirage, that shimmering on the horizon, appear to come closer to him. And you know, he strained all his powers of attention to look. And it did seem as if there was a person on a sled being pulled by husky dogs. And he thought, he's got sort of brain damage from the hot sun. But then he heard these dogs start barking. He said, this is weird. And there was a person there in a fur coat in the middle of the desert. He said, this is really weird. It can't be true. I'm hallucinating. And as this dog sled came right up to him and the dog started licking him, and the man in the furs said, are you okay? Have some water. And the man, squatting on his hands and knees, was just so excited. I'm saved, you found me. I've been lost in the desert for days. And the Inuit, he used to call them Eskimos, the Inuit said, and you think you're lost? Look, I can't give a talk without a joke. It's just, I can't do it. But the doubt, how do you know how to meditate? Yeah, you can listen to me and think, oh yeah, Jampam's a good meditator, he's got lots of disciples, he's doing this for such a long time, he hasn't been found out yet, so it must be true, after 50 years. Or whatever you use to try and justify it, so taking what I say on board. But that doesn't really count, does it? But you know, there is, I mentioned this to you, I think, it's kind of difficult being a monk, because you're not allowed Father Vinaya to go into too much detail about any amazing experiences you've had. But again, I already mentioned to you, I did study the Vinaya, that's a monk's rules, and I do know the loopholes. Anyway, it's pushing the boundary a little bit, but I think I can get away with this. That once, many years ago in Bodhinyana Monastery, I was meditating, nice meditation, maybe 30, 40 years ago, I think now. So, 30 years ago. So when I was meditating there, and nice meditation, and when you came out of the meditation, you're just emerging, I decided to do a little exercise. I don't know where this came from. Well, why I decided to do it this way, why I decided to do it at all. Obviously, it's probably from past lives. I asked myself, what is my earliest memory? So just sitting there in the hall, what is my earliest memory? Straight away, maybe a second or 2 seconds pause, and then I could experience myself in my baby's pram. As a maybe 6 or 7, 8 week old baby. It wasn't a memory in the same sense as you remember what you had for breakfast this morning. It was a re-experiencing. I was back in my baby's pram. You can see its colours are just black and white, nothing fancy. And the other thing which I remember from that experience was my favourite toy when I was only a newborn baby, which was a little light blue, not plastic, I think it was made of some sort, it could have been plastic, or it was ceramic, pig. And my mother gave it the nickname Porky, very original, but that's what it was called, Porky the pig. And it had some sort of beans or something inside, so she could shake it. And I was delighted in my little toy, Porky the pig, and sometimes she would walk it and it'd make it go, you know, rattle along. But one of the other things I remember from that experience was that I recognized everything, you know, in my baby's pram, the little pig, and especially my mother, not by how she looked. That was not important. The colors didn't matter at all. What I recognized my mother by was by her smell. At that particular time, as a little baby, I recognized my world by how it smelt, never by how it looked or by my mother's sound. And that was weird. And of course, I like telling these stories to people. And once I told this story to, like, a doctor who looks after kids being born, and he was quite surprised. I've checked it out afterwards, it's true that your brain, when it first comes out of your mother's womb, that part of the brain is dominant, smell, not sight, the sight grows later on, not sound, but smell. That's how even like dogs recognize people. They come and smell you. And if you're a friend, you know, they start wagging their tail. Smell is dominant. It's weird that you got that little bit of information which kind of verified that experience. But that verification was not needed at all. And the reason was is because as I was re-experiencing that early life memory, I had no doubt at all that that was me. It was as clear as if, even clearer than just seeing the little platypus over there. Am I imagining that? No, it's real. But this is even more real. I never realized at the time, it took me actually years, I'm so stupid, that the reason why you could recall that early life memory, you can go back earlier if you want to past lives, the reason if you do it through meditation, and then you can recall these events, you're right living there. It's not like a distant memory. You're right in there. And the reason was because you can only do that if the five hindrances are gone. So there you know, that was one time, is really sure that the fifth hindrance of doubt had vanished. And it's kind of weird. Why was it, you know, I was trained as a scientist, you know, to be objective, don't take things for granted, doubt, check, challenge. But there you had an experience and you felt what it's like to have no doubt at all. It was not an intellectual position I was taking, it was an experiential position. When those five hindrances are gone, one of them, which is doubt, has vanished, then you see things absolutely clearly. And you're not deluded. So how do you know those five hindrances are gone? And there's one way to know those five hindrances are gone, and that is jhana again. I don't know why I keep sort of biting my tongue to say jhana again, because people say, that's who I ever teach Ajahn Brahm, jhanas. And I say, yes. Because it's when those jhanas are experienced. Yeah, they're fun at the time, but once you emerge from those jhanas, that's one of the clear results. The five hindrances disappear for a while. The deeper the jhana, the longer you experience that jhana, the more those five hindrances are not present. You don't have any desire. You don't have any aversion for a while. That by itself is quite weird. And as I mentioned, that's how we try and understand if a person is deceiving themselves and trying to deceive their teacher. Was it really a jhana? That's why I try to irritate you. I said this before, but on one of these stories, this was, I think one of Tsung Po's stories, you know, Chinese genius. And he said once there was a monk in a monastery in China, and he decided he wanted to really get into some meditation. And he said the best way to do that is have some seclusion. He went to see the boss, the abbot, in this monastery in China, mainland China, and he said, not far away from here, quite a short distance, there is a lake, and in the middle of that lake, there is an island. No one lives there. Can I just go to that island and build a small cave, a small hut, like a kuti, we call them, only small, and I will make a little vegetable patch. All I would ask is once a week that you send an attendant over to that island with some rice, maybe some matches, or anything else which is really necessary, and I won't ask for much. And I want to live there in solitude to really get into the meditation with no disturbance at all. And the abbot said, yes, good idea. So he went over to that island, he built a really secluded hut, comfortable but not over the top, and once a week the attendant would come over and bring him what he'd asked for the week before and take anything he needed, any orders for the next week. For 3 years he practiced on that island, this monk, and then he thought he was fully enlightened. Now what to do? So he told the attendant one week, please bring me some parchment, some ink, and a quill pen. He wants to write some calligraphy. So 1 week later, the parchment, the ink, and the pen came. And this monk, he never wrote anything straight away. He sat down, he meditated, and maybe the next day meditated, and maybe the third or fourth day's meditation was so deep, when he came out of meditation, he wrote this exquisite calligraphy in a poem in four lines. The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the four worldly winds. And even in Theravada we use that simile, the four worldly winds. If you're not moved by them, it means you're enlightened. So he wrote it, let it dry, and rolled it up, and waited for the attendant to come. And he gave the attendant this parchment. He said, please offer this to the abbot. And then 1 week later, the attendant came with the reply. And the reply from the abbot was like his own parchment returned. And he opened up the parchment, and his eyes went wide open, his face went red, and again he almost had a heart attack. Because over that first line of exquisite calligraphy, the diligent monk, the abbot had written, just in biro pen, the four letters F-A-H-T, fart. On the second line, diligent monk, alone for 3 years, he wrote another F-A, I don't know if you spell it H-T or R-T, it doesn't really matter. How would you spell it if you were the abbot? Anyway, H-T. This time in capital letters, fart. And the third line is no longer moved. A big F-A-H-T with exclamation mark after it. And the fourth line, by the four worldly winds, a really huge F-A-H-T, underlined three times and three exclamation marks. And this monk was just so upset. This was an expression of a new enlightened monk's skill with this exquisite calligraphy. This calligraphy should have gone in some museum somewhere. It should be revered. And this stupid abbot has scrawled all over it. Not like a monk, more like a punk. So he got up and he shouted after the attendant who was just rowing away, come back, come back. Take me to see the abbot now. So he went across the lake, first time in 3 years, stormed into the abbot's office. Explain yourself, said this angry monk. So the abbot very quietly stood up, took the scroll, opened it out, and read it. The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the four worldly winds. Yet four farts have blown you clean across the lake. I kind of like that. So that's one of the reasons why, if you are enlightened or even just a deep meditation, nothing can upset you. Nothing. Nothing can make you afraid. Those five hindrances have calmed all those negative emotions down. So that's how we find out, you know, if you've had a deep meditation. If it really is a deep meditation, those five hindrances are gone for a while. But this is from the Nalakapana Sutta. I don't make this stuff up, it's in the suttas. In the Nalakapana Sutta, it's not just the five hindrances. It's also these two extra qualities. I have mentioned them in one of the talks earlier. Arati and Tandi. Arati is like discontent. Just nothing can make you discontent. Whatever's happening, okay, it's fine. And if ever you've had a deep meditation, notice how true that is. You're like walking on air. Your head's up in the cloud. Sometimes you've got a stupid smile on your face. Oh, it's raining. Oh, there's a tsunami coming. Oh, we're having a nuclear war this afternoon. Nothing can upset you. You're just full of energy and positivity. And also, the other thing which has disappeared is what they call Tandi, a decent translation, called it weariness. Do ever you feel tired? And sometimes when you get old, like me, in the 70s, Do you feel weary? Get up in the morning. Oh, no, not another day. That weariness is gone. And that is strange. I don't know if you've noticed, the last couple of days I've been much more silly with my jokes and everything else. I can't help it. I told Ajahn Mamani that, look, he gets a bit fed up with me being silly, same old jokes again. But nevertheless, sometimes that's what happens. You get bubbly, you get joy, energy coming up. That's also what happens when those five hindrances disappear. That's why, as a teacher, I can tell if your five hindrances are gone or not. Of course, how do they go? It's one of the main reasons why they go is, again, through the experience of deep meditation, through the jhanas. That's one of the reasons why the Buddha said, samadhi paccaya yata buddhi anadasanam. It's those jhanas are the cause for seeing things as they really are. But in between, seeing things as they really are, the jhanas and the seeing things as they really are the suppression of the five hindrances. Those five hindrances just are not there for a while. Because they're not there for a while, there's nothing to distort your insight. What you see is real, is true. So what are those things which you see, which are evidence? Because I was a scientist, I call them data. You're actually seeing real data. And that gives you the opportunity to, with the mind free of those hindrances, to see it clearly and understand what it means. I mentioned one of those stories yesterday. I mentioned it again because it's such an important simile, the tadpole and the frog. Tadpoles can't understand water. Even though it's all around them, they live in it, they were born in it, it's right there. How can they understand water? I think many of you have heard that many times before. I remember the Crown Prince of Thailand some years ago. And he said, what's it like, you know, being a prince? He said, how would I know? Well, you are a prince. But I've been a prince since I was born. I lived all my life as a prince. I know nothing else except being a prince. How could I know what a prince is? No more than knowing what a fish is. A fish is born in the water, lives all its life in the water. It doesn't know what water is. But what happens when the tadpole becomes a frog? Now you know the tadpole can actually jump out of the water and can survive on the dry land. Now just imagine what that must be like. The first time in your life, you know, you jump. You don't know what you're doing, you don't know where you're going, but you jump and you're on dry land. Wow. This is really different. Imagine what it's like if you're sitting on a meditation retreat and you press this letting go button and now you're in the first jhana. It's like nothing you've experienced before. Wow, that's weird. Very weird. But the thing is, while you're in those states, you can't really contemplate them. You're too still. But when you come out afterwards, as a few of you have told me, and it's absolutely correct, when you have these big experiences, sometimes it could be years ago, and you can still remember them, clearly. Because they're intense experiences. The only simile which you could give, which makes a little bit of sense, but it's not perfect, traumas. You know, you've had a car crash. You know, you've been shot at or something, and you think you're dying. You know, you get heightened awareness. And because of that heightened awareness, you never forget those memories. It's like they're branded into your memory. But they're unpleasant. And I think it's quite strange that in Western culture, the only strong, unforgettable memories which people say are the traumatic ones, not the beautiful ones, which is quite a shame. But there are people who've had very deep meditative experiences, and they will never forget them. They're too strong to forget. Now imagine that happens. You've just had a deep meditation, and you come out afterwards, half an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 10 hours later, of course you can't forget it. You just look at it, and it's right there. And that is where you start to understand exactly what it was, and what was happening, and why it was happening, and all the details. That is the data, the evidence, the raw, rare data on which the deep insights can come from. It's not just seeing things the ordinary way, you're actually seeing things which are very rare. Like the first thing, when the first jhana, it's not seeing what's there as much as seeing what's missing, what's not there, what's always been there and now is gone. And that, first of all, is your five senses. They're unavailable. They're just not there. You think, well, that's nothing. That sometimes I don't experience my five senses. Sometimes I go to sleep and the five senses aren't active. Sometimes I can get anesthetic when I'm going to the hospital and it's not there. So what's the big deal? But this time, you know, the mind is very aware. And so you have a full experience of what it's like just to have the mind sense, the sixth sense, and the other five senses have anicchat. Something which was always there has now gone. And I mentioned that the other evening or something, when people asked me about anicca. Rise and fall is not the full picture. It's almost a deceiving translation. What it really wants to show you is something which has always been there. Because it's always been there, you don't notice it. You know, I was just saying to one of the monks the other day, have you ever seen darkness? Real darkness? You know, for years, I was 19 years of age when I first experienced darkness. It was because I was born in London. There's always street lights. You never saw real darkness. You can turn on the lights in your bedroom, but there's always some reflected light somewhere in a great city like London. And I will confess to you that I saw that darkness because I was walking home from a pub with my girlfriend. And it was totally dark. Couldn't see anything. And that was weird. I thought that you'd know what darkness is, but that was the first time this thing called light had totally vanished. So sometimes we can assume we know things, but we don't until they really go. Imagine everything goes. Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. It comes back later on, you don't need to be afraid, but it's gone for a while. That's weird. It also tells you a little bit about what happens when you die. What is death anyway? I'm not talking about dying. Dying is kind of unpleasant sometimes. You know, painful, and people are always struggling and making a noise trying to keep you alive. But actually the death itself, when you go past that point and it's irreversible, you're dead. What freedom. You haven't got this heavy five senses to worry about for a while. That's one of the reasons, if you really get into this meditation and you know, experience what it's like for these five senses to disappear, that's bliss. You experience it not just as a freedom from a burden, but as a great opposite. Oh wow, freedom at last. It's like you've been working so hard. And now it's retreat time. If you know how to stop working when you go on a retreat. Many of you change your job description, but it's still doing the same job. trying to achieve something, trying to get rid of things, trying to arrange things, trying to make this work and that work and something else work. For goodness sake, let go. You don't have to worry about the food. Someone else is cooking that. You don't have to worry about paying your rent. You don't have any rent here. You don't have to worry about achieving everything. Sometimes I thought of doing that, is giving out certificates at the end of the retreat. Grading you. If you graded yourself, what grade would you give yourself? F? First of all, I say that not just as a joke, but how many people always think badly of themselves? If I ask you to grade yourself, you probably put, and be honest about it, you probably put F, or maybe E. That's if you're proud and arrogant. But you know, one of the nice things about insights and wisdom, you don't judge yourself at all. You don't know. A, B, C, D, E, F. It's uncertain. How can you judge yourself, honestly? So anyway, when you let go of those five senses, it's all of freedom. You know, all of your trauma from the past, the bad memories, and good memories too, all of the fears of the future, it's all about five sense stuff. Nothing to do with the mind. So imagine that you let those go, take away their importance. Imagine how free you can feel. Not worried about the five senses at all. And if you can do that, really do that, you'll be a non-returner. Never coming back to the world of the five senses, it doesn't make any sense for you at all. See how the insights work? These are experiential. You see this. That's where you get nibbida, as I said the other day, to the world of the five senses. What's to come back here? If I gave you a choice, would you like to become a non-return and never come back to this realm, or just have another go at the five sense world? Most people think, well, they got it wrong last time in this life, but now they've learned something. Now they know how to have a relationship. Next time I won't have any kids. They don't realize the whole system is going to be like this. So the best is to get out if you have the opportunity. I have said this, you know, thank you for asking for that story about the worm in the pile of dung. But you know, there's another simile which I love using, and that is the prisoner in jail. There was this woman. She was born in jail, and she lived in jail. She grew up in jail. And she's a very good woman. They really worked hard, had a good reputation. So they gave her a really nice prison cell with a nice garden outside. And then she found another nice little prisoner, a man, and they fell in love. They went, you know, to the dances and the disco, or whatever you have these days, in the jail, and they fell in love. And they got given a nice bigger cell in the prison, in the married section. And eventually he worked very hard. He still had to pay a lot for the mortgage for this prison cell. And then they soon had a couple of nice kids. They sent the kids to the school in the jail, just where the woman and the man went to. And they looked after their kids. And they're having a wonderful time. Sometimes they would have holidays to another part of the prison. And they thought that life was, sometimes suffering. They couldn't always do what they wanted to. But, it was okay. Everyone else was pretty much the same. Compared to others, they were doing pretty well. Until somebody came along with a bald head and said, "Don't you realize prison is suffering?" "No, it's not suffering. It's just your bad attitude. You monastics are just so negative. So instead of saying that, the monastic said, well, look, you can have a better life in jail if you learn how to meditate. You can get your work done quicker, higher quality, you don't argue so much with each other and your kids, you can be so more peaceful with your kids. Do some meditation. And so they do some meditation, and while they're meditating, it's like they find like a tunnel in their cell. And they go into that tunnel. And the tunnel says, if you want to go through this tunnel, you have to have 8 qualities. Right view, right motivation, right speech, action, livelihood, effort, I forget what I usually call it these days, right mindfulness and right stillness. And if you do that, you can get to the end of the tunnel. And so they decide to give it a go. And they find it leads outside of the prison. And the first time in their lives, they realize what freedom is. Not as a theory, but as an experience. They have to go back, but that changes their whole life. They realize all these years, they thought they were living in Australia. Now they realize they've been living in prison. The prison of the 5 senses. And the prison keepers, these officers always give you a hard time. They all got the same name. Will. And Will tortures you. Never allows you one moment of peace. You're trying to watch your breath and the Will says, oh no, don't do it this way, do it that way. And the Will says, no, don't think of this, think of that. And the Will says, you should be doing something better than that. Do some volunteering. Have a cup of tea. Do something. Your will never allows you to be peaceful. So that's why when we're meditating, we trick the will. Just be calm. And eventually, the prison officer called Will eventually falls asleep. And allows you to go into deep meditation. Because that's what happens in the second jhana. The second jhana, you know, you jump a bit further. Something else which has always been there is now missing. And this is weird stuff. Will, choice, is no longer there during the experience of the deep meditations. Something which people are just so possessive of. You know, people do have demonstrations, they overthrow governments, they have big political movements, so they can have free will. Ha ha ha. Because they all think that free will protect them. And then monastics, they don't get much choice at all. Why do you do that? Ajahn Brahm, I was a theoretical physicist, I could be wealthy by now. I could be living in some mansion with a butlers attending to my every need. Why don't you do that? Because I know just how much suffering that is. Just being able to sit down still and don't want anything in the whole world. And if somebody came up to me and said, Ajahn Brahm, I grant you 3 wishes. I remember the story of what that did to the bear and the rabbit. And how that caused so much trouble. So I said, no thank you. Imagine that, Desi, I said, do you want the correct lottery number for this week? And you knew that I could give it to you. Would you accept it? I'm not going to do that. But imagine that that was true. Can you refuse it? Can you say, no, thank you? It's amazing when you can understand what will, what choice is, where it comes from, and let it disappear. And And that's what happens in that second jhana. There's no will at all. It's not that you decide not to exercise the will. There is no will. There's no mouse, there's no button, there's nothing to press. I don't have to make a decision. What freedom. How many decisions have you had to make in life? You try your best to make sure it's a good decision. Sometimes you make mistakes, it's a bad decision. But wouldn't it be wonderful if you didn't have to make any decisions at all? Totally free. You're sitting there, you have everything you need, nothing missing. You don't have to make any decisions, any choices. Ah, freedom. That's the bliss of a second jhana. That really is bliss. Having the time of your lives. I always mention that. Not the time of your life. It's more than one life. It's really blissing out. So each of these little deep meditations, you're getting experience which is almost unmissable. Strong, powerful. You come out after, wow, that was really something. The only reason why some people who do get into deep meditation don't get those enlightening insights is that they basically have them, it's important, but they don't know how to understand them. Which one of the reasons why it's important to have teachers who know what they're talking about. That's why it's the second thing which you need to actually to see the Dhamma, to have enlightenment experiences. Not just the deep meditations, but the paratagosa, the words of another. The words of another enlightened being. The words of, say, of an Ajahn Chah. When he said something, that really meant something to me. It was much more powerful. So, I'm going over time again. Do you mind? Okay, the one last insight story? Yeah. This is one of my favorites. Many of you have heard this before, but it's true, accurate. This is what happened. In this last years of healthy life, Ajahn Chah was getting sick. He was giving too much, working too hard. People would always come and see him from in the morning to the evening, and he never took time off for himself. So if ever, you know, I try and shorten the interviews, it's not because I'm disrespectful of you. I need some time to relax and rest. But Ajahn Chah never did that. But anyway, 1 year or a couple of years before he got like a stroke and he couldn't speak anymore, that the monks, including myself, we studied the Vinaya and we discovered one thing which wasn't well known in Thailand. I don't know if it's well known in Sri Lanka. But in the time of the Buddha, there were saunas for monks. Saunas were not invented in Sweden. Buddhist monasticism had them 2,000 years before then. So we decided, why don't we build a sauna? Now maybe Ajahn Chah could get more healthy with that. That was only number two reason. The main reason was if we built a sauna, we had an excuse to invite Ajahn Chah to come over every week to take his sauna, but also to give us a talk. And it worked perfectly. We built the sauna for him, and he'd come over every week. He'd always give us a talk, and then have a sauna. And usually, this is your teacher, so you always want to do some sort of service for them. So usually when he'd come over, you'd hear the talk, then you'd go and help him with his sauna. But this 1 week, he gave a brilliant talk. You know, sometimes you hear a Dhamma talk, and oh my goodness, it just goes right inside of you, and you start blissing out listening to the talk. So that time I said, there's enough monks to look after Ajahn Chah. I went round the back of the hall, on the concrete, no cushions, crossed my legs, and did a nice 2-hour meditation. Really happy. And when I came out of that meditation, the first thought was, maybe there's some time. know, to help my teacher. He's given me so much. So I went towards the sauna. I realized I was too late. He'd already finished his sauna, because I saw him walking along the path, you know, going to his car to go back to Wat Pa Pong. We were going to cross mid-path. I'd just come out of very deep meditation, and he came towards me and he started looking at me in the eyes. I can't say about any monks who are alive reading minds, but this was a time you could feel that Ajahn Chah inside my mind. It's a hard thing to describe, but he was reading my mind. And for once, I was happy he was reading my mind. Other days I'll be embarrassed. So he was just looking at me, and I don't know how you can describe it, you felt he was just having a look inside. And then afterwards, he looked at me firmly. I'm not afraid, but really fierce. He said, "Brahma Wangsa, why?" You're like sharp. And I said, "I don't know." I was only a Cambridge graduate, nothing more than that. Whenever you said something stupid like that, it's amazing, these great monks, they would just laugh their head off. They thought it was so funny. And people with all these big degrees were so idiotic. But then he screwed his mind up again. He said, "Brahma Wangsa, I will tell you the answer." And I was really interested. You know, he'd obviously seen out of my, you know, hindrances were gone for a while, and he really wanted to see if he could enlighten one of his disciples. "I'll tell you the answer. If anybody asks you the question why, the answer is, there's nothing. My mirai, there's nothing." He looked at me, "Do you understand?" I said, "Yes." He said, "No, you don't." And he walked away. That was a wonderful experience. That's what a Dhamma discourse is. Get to the point of it. Why? The answer is nothing. Even though I didn't understand then, it does take a while to penetrate that. What does that mean? Do you understand? Okay, I won't even say anything. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.